This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hey, Francisco. Thanks for joining me.
Absolutely, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
You're the Director of Data Science and Analytics at the Howard Hughes Institute near Washington, D.C.
Correct.
In Chevy Chase, Maryland. But you started out your career as an undergraduate student of history at the University of Michigan, where you also did an honors program. And I know lots of things happened between your BA and your present role. For instance, you did a PhD in public policy and education at Indiana University. Still, I was wondering if there's a way to connect the dots between your historical education and your choices and accomplishments later and your responsibilities right now. So maybe I could start at the beginning, what seems like a beginning, and ask you a very basic question.
Sure.
Why did you do a BA in history?
I absolutely love history. I've known that since I was a little kid. History, to me, explains why. Why am I seeing what I'm actually seeing in present-day society? Knowing full well that everything around us doesn't emerge or happen in a vacuum. So it actually started with, you know, growing up along the borderlands and the U.S.-Mexico border. Why does the border exist where it exists, right? Those are the kind of questions I was asking. Why is Mexico called Mexico? Why is the United States called the, you know, like these very basic fundamental questions about my place in the world. And it was very much a process about self-discovery as it was about explanation. And, you know, Michigan is a phenomenal university. The honors program is tough. And even there, I was asking in 13th century Spain, how did Jews, Christians, and Muslims live together in what is commonly called the convivencia? And it was, again, wanting to know why and how. What is it? What was the secret sauce happening in this period of time when nobody got along, frankly?
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting how this question actually of medieval and early modern Spain is relevant to our concerns about, you know, about cohabitation and tolerance and diversity today in many ways, right? Which is why I think it's also become kind of a popular topic, very stimulating topic.
Yeah, because I mean, I think, you know, there are these underlying things that we see in history all the time, right? And I think the two biggest ones in my mind are what really changes and what really stays the same.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, you know, you can read a newspaper or read some book about some current affair, some current issue. And, you know, that's great, that's lovely, but really what's the source in everything that we're looking at? And you can sort of begin to see, I think, with enough perspective, more or less how a lot of things would shake out, because really what we're seeing right now has happened many, many times before we ever got to this point.
Right. Did you write a thesis for your honors program?
Yeah, it wasn't good. Well, yeah, I wrote one.
What was it about?
I'm very candid. So it was on this concept of convivencia. At the time, I was lucky enough to have met Maria Rosa Menocal, who is an incredible historian at Yale who has since passed. And she took about an hour out of her day to talk with me. And I was incredibly appreciative. I was about to sit down in this beautiful office in Connecticut. And I just realized at the time, just the language requirements and the amount of coursework you have to do in order to begin the process of doing fieldwork. And so Professor Manipala was saying, like, well, you know, you've got to take, you know, X amount of courses in Arabic, X amount of courses in Hebrew. You know, it's true you're fluent in Spanish, but it's not the same kind of Spanish, the very particular kind of earlier form of Spanish you've got to get familiar with. You know, so it's going to be about, you know, maybe 3 to 4 years before you actually start.
Yeah.
Have the ability to read original sources.
Having fun in many ways.
Yeah. So, and I knew at that moment, I'm like, man, I love history, but the language requirements, absolutely not. At the time, it was a hard decision, but I don't regret it. I mean, I can do a lot of reading and a lot of thinking on my own without having to hack 3 years of Arabic. And to be frank, like, I know people who have done it, and hats off to them.
Yeah. Can you talk about the relationship between your undergrad history background and your choice to pursue a graduate degree in public policy and education? What pushed you in that direction?
Sure. So after I graduated, I took 2 years off, mainly because at that time, everyone I knew was either pursuing a PhD somewhere, going to medical school, going to law school, or getting a job. And I looked around, and for me, I think the salience of how can you meaningfully give back and to the communities that you care about? And of course, for some people, you know, means going to law school or and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And for me, I understand the world through opportunity costs. I understand the world through money and finances and the importance that can play in generating opportunities. Because we're in the American context, I mean, certain things can only happen through public policy. Mm-hmm. There's no other way around it. People talk about meeting structural fixes. Well, you have to go through public policy to fix certain things. And so ended up going to Indiana, and I'm smiling right now because my advisor is very kind, but he was absurdly rigorous to the point where his entire thing, if I had to paraphrase, his name's Bradley Levinson, by the way. The way I would describe Bradley is a very cool uncle, and at the same time, he had no issues telling me where you could be better. Mm-hmm. And I asked him one time, like, hey, paraphrasing, like, why are you so rough? And he'd say, like, well, I know how good you are and how good you could be. So if I didn't care about you, I wouldn't be this rough on you. And that basic insight and that basic advice and mentoring actually, for me personally, really paid off. And, you know, when I got to Indiana, everything I wanted to study was around, I had to distill it down. How do poor marginalized students even make it to a college university? Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the day, how do you do it? Because, you know, you don't have any money. You live where you live. The opportunities aren't that great. The job environment's not stellar. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you end up becoming classmates with little class, double middle class kids. Just how do you do it?
That's a fascinating question, yeah. And a historical one in some ways, in the sense that it deals with change over time and choices. And speaking of choices, I also wanted to say that I like how you talk about your choices in the past. And I don't know if you've gained that clarity recently, ex post facto, or did you make those intentional turns, you know, away from history into something more applicable, policy at that time, very keenly aware of where this is going, you know?
I mean, I think part of it, frankly, was being able to understand where is historical thinking, and I don't mean this as a knock, but where is historical thinking not as prevalent as it could be or should be?
Yeah.
Why is it not there? Right. And my general thing at the time was go to spaces where you are the new kid on the block.
Right.
Where you can sometimes feel like an outsider, but you meaningfully have something to contribute to what people are doing, saying.
Yeah.
And in my world, funding. Like, that to me is sort of a general leap where history gave me perspective, it gave me context.
Yeah.
It allowed me to see, frankly, what isn't there. You know, a common method you and I know in earlier conversations, I mentioned, you know, historiography and the methods that we use to try to understand.
Yeah. And we'll get to this for sure. Yes.
Yeah. You know, but that's exactly what it takes me to, you know, how are people, I, how do, And the thing that I see a lot of people not doing, and I don't know why this is the case, right? But it's like, take the biggest ideas from different walks of life. It can be different disciplines. It can be different people. And just figuring out how you can apply that. Yeah, I never understood why there's an insularity in certain areas, because we more in certain fields, we know what the answers are to certain questions.
Right.
And we can go in depth and we can over nuance at times. And it's like saying, go to the field of social psychology. and go hang out with them, have a cup of coffee, read their books, and then come back into your field and say, well, how can I make the familiar strange in a really productive way that gives me new insight to go back to my really horrible undergraduate thesis, like, how do people get along, right? Like, it's a really simple question that, you know, frankly, you can't answer from a historical perspective alone. You gotta go somewhere else to figure out what is the underlying juju that's making this happen.
Yeah. So, you actually answer a lot of questions that a couple of questions that I had.
Yeah.
About you going into more kind of applied sciences, you know, part of it, obviously, your school years are in some ways haunting you a little bit.
I think what it is, it's just, the older I get, it's sort of, I'll take this as a sign of personal growth, right? I was, 21 when I wrote an undergraduate thesis, right? You're great on top of the world. Then you used to grow up and life happens. You get a little more seasoning as you go older.
Right.
Yeah. Back and you're like, man, I didn't know anything. I was doing the best.
Of course, I was kidding, but it helps understand, you know, why you didn't go into academia, which was my other question. But you did go to, you got a first job at Duke, right, where you were doing institutional assessment, and that helps me to connect, you know, your thinking there. How did that make you grow?
So there, it's figured out very quickly that. So let me take a step back. So at Duke, there were three broad areas, right, that a lot of my work took place in. You know, on one hand, there's a lot of work around data. How do we know it's accurate? What do we know that's coming in? Are there any things that we need to develop that should be there that aren't, right? So those kind of very straightforward traditional questions. There's another piece around assessment and evaluation. So I think at the time there were ballparkish 90 master's and PhD programs. So it's coming out with a common framework within which a lot of those programs can evaluate themselves. Like, what does growth look like? What does success look like? And how do you know, right? Like, these very simple questions and helping, you know, if it really is biophysics or history or sociology or another program, you get through for themselves, you know, reemphasizing that it's not about me, it's about where you want to be in 5 years. And the last part was around these larger questions around accreditation, actually, which is something I never expected to be doing. So I was on the team that helped with Duke's reaccreditation that we completed in 2020, which is 3 years ago, which I don't know where time goes in a pandemic. But you begin to see how institutions operate. Day-to-day life, how decisions are made. You get to see very quickly, you know, there's the difference between what's posted online and how things actually work in real life. And, you know, that to me, I think was super eye-opening. You know, I think as a student, we have a conception of how things work.
Right.
Then you sort of go to the other, quote unquote, the other side.
Right. I was going to say, you crossed over. You sold,
the
institution
sorry.
from the other side, and you cannot unsee it probably. So I have questions about your present role now.
Of course.
You work at the Howard Hughes Institute, which I see describes itself as a science philanthropy. Could you talk more about what it is, having been on the inside for a while now?
Sure. I love what I do. Let me start there. So on an annual basis, so we are the largest private funder of biomedical and biological research in the country. I think we are second behind the NIH in terms of total entities that exist in the United States. About on an annual basis, I think we fund ballpark-ish about $750 million for medical research as well as for science education. And so I'm currently in the Center for Scientific Leadership and Culture within the center. And you know, there's two big umbrellas under which a lot of my work falls. On one hand, I help a lot with data and data science questions. So it's not the, you know, everything you see on the press with like ChatGPT and the super sophisticated, you know, everything that everyone's talking about. I think of me as, on one hand, as being a mechanic, right? It's looking at process. It's looking at governance. It's looking at taxonomies. It's looking at different ways we can poke holes in different models if we decide to develop them, right? And the second part is really around, you know, what are we missing?
About what? What are you missing?
Yeah, what are we missing, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm working with a program and they're developing something, or if there is a question about, you know, how we build out certain teams, like, is there expertise that we just don't have, right? Those kind of questions. So yeah, I really dig it, and I feel super lucky.
How did you discover this organization?
Yeah, so when I was at Duke, I was deeply involved with a lot of our science programs, right? So some programs were undergoing the external review process. My boss was a cell biologist. Over time, you just get to meet people, right? Whether it's meal, coffee, a pint, whatever, right. You get to meet people. And slowly over time, you start to learn where money comes from. Mm-hmm. You start to learn more about how does research actually get done. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the fascinating questions is that there was an initiative at Duke for Alzheimer's research. And talking to people about, well, you know, they approached me and asked, you know, we want to make the leap from being an initiative to being an institute, which means they're a formal part of the university structure. Mm-hmm. What do we need to collect to make those kind of arguments?
Mm-hmm.
And so really, really quickly, you know, I go from knowing nothing about how the science world works, how science research happens, who the players are, how the influence of publications to, you know, this question around open access science and the public's ability to view and engage with actual scientific research to knowing more than knowing more than most people. And so I think it was in 2001. Yeah, somebody forwarded me a job description to HMI, and they didn't have to sell me on, you know, what does this company do? How does it work? All of the underlying, very straightforward questions are, I mean, yeah, I had the answer.
You knew everything.
And it just made sense. Yeah, it just made sense. Mm-hmm. And similar to the basic idea of being able to go to different fields, it just makes sense. So initially, it started out finance and operations. And 2 years later, I am in some.
And just a quick follow-up to the earlier question. You mentioned ChatGPT. Do you actually work with artificial intelligence models in any capacity?
We're experimenting right now. We're experimenting right now. What I can say is we're grappling with a lot of the questions that a lot of people around the country are trying to figure out right now.
Yeah, okay. Right?
So it's anything from, quite frankly, what's the structure of that? Organizes and holds a lot of things behind the scenes together. How do we segment different data sets? How do we define what learning means if we come up with a particular model? To quite frankly, like, how do we put on our devil's advocate hat and poke as many holes in it as possible? What we do know about ChatGPT and large language models is that they're referenced against the entire internet, basically. People are finding out in ways large and small that they're not all that reliable. They're getting better.
Right.
And at the same time, for my uses, there's a lot of work to be done on the analysis piece. And there is this tension that exists in my world where somebody will approach me and say, like, hey, listen, we want to do this really cool and fancy thing. And there's two things I usually tell them, right? It's like, okay, that's really great. You want to do all this sophisticated, fancy stuff. But I have to talk to you about, like, what is the foundational house holding everything together? How good is your process? How good is your governance? What does your data look like when it comes through the door? Because the fancy stuff doesn't really matter if the stuff going in isn't
interesting.
And, you know, the second part of it is that I really love is that nobody's figured it out yet, really. Like, everyone's trying to figure out this macro theme of, what is digital transformation mean? And people will say, like, again, historical thinking. A lot of things that currently people are talking about right now have been in existence for a very long time. And so this question of what's really new or innovative begins to take center stage. And then, you know, you can imagine from a business perspective, is it really worth it?
That's an excellent comment and a great segue maybe for sort of my big question that I'm very eager to ask you as someone who, since you have a BA in history and you're so reflective about how you navigate these different twists and turns in life and at your different roles. So I'm really curious about what you have to say about, you know, how do you feel history fits into your work? Maybe you could elaborate what you just said, or maybe add something if you think it's, you know, worth developing. But I know that there's some role that it plays in your work.
Yeah. So there's three, right? I think the first one is how institutions have developed historically. In my world, and this is just to make it a little bit more concrete, there is this ongoing tension that we have around how do we meaningfully broaden who can participate in certain institutions? Mm-hmm. And the most public
such as universities, for instance.
Yes. Speaking explicitly around the affirmative action case that was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So it's ultimately this question of, you know, what does it mean to broaden? What does it mean to, what does equality mean in this context? Mm-hmm. I think everyone is still trying to figure out. In the 1970s, what affirmative action and how it was defined and how it was practiced is very different. You know, and I think it was in 96 with the University of Texas at Austin, that morphed into the educational benefits of diversity was the key phrase that came out. I was a freshman at Michigan when the Bollinger and Grutter decision came down, which, and at the time you could sort of feel it, where again, everything is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking in terms of what's legally allowed. But it's because of that understanding that gives me insight into being able to say, like, listen, you have to be really creative. We know what the problems are. We know what the challenges are based on all kinds of numbers, all kinds of research, all kinds of studies. So what do we do about it? The second part, history is context. You know, one of the things that I'm not an old man, but I feel like an old man sometimes because everything around me is basically saying, whether we're talking about social media, whether we're talking about technologies or how much we live in an attention economy, that it feels like thinking and taking my time is countercultural. You know, I can't make a decision on something meaningful. I need to think about it. And I can't give you a timeline as to when, and I've done a sufficient amount of research where I have my mind fully made up, because it's not just, and again, this is the policy part of my brain coming from history. You have the primary effects of whatever it is that we're talking about.
Right.
And you start to understand how certain things can spill over into second and third order effects. And then, you know, the first thing you learn in policy school is, you know, the law of unintended consequences. You start doing something, you think it's going to be great, and some time goes by and you realize, like, man, I really, as an example, you know, I really had an answer looking for a solution. It didn't work out.
Right.
Back with hindsight, it's obvious. And then I see a lot of people trying to clean up messes because there were assumptions that weren't tested in the first place. Right. And I think about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is interesting. I was wondering if you experienced maybe a moment like this in your present role where you know, I guess the bigger question is, do you feel like you can actually take this time to reflect on the context in your present role, which, as you said, I think you're right, it's countercultural. We are kind of bombarded with so many things and prodded to action so often that I wonder where you stand and how you position yourself in your role. And then, did you have a moment, this is also related to what you just said, where you kind of took your pause and reflected over something and said, okay, well, having considered context, actually, I need to move in a different direction, and which is where history would have kind of applied in some way, I suppose?
Yeah, so where history influences what I do all the time, I'm always asking the question, how and under what conditions does change actually happen? You know, and I think a lot about not just context, but I think a lot about structure, like organizational structure in this matter, right? There are a lot of places, whether they're companies, whether they're private, public, doesn't matter, but they're very hierarchical in nature. We have particular units, we have teams embedded with units, people who embed with teams that are better units. And, you know, that's a product of 150 years of just organizations, very Durkheimian way of seeing the world, right?
Yeah.
Then there's a, in my mind, okay, that's great. That's all that exists on one hand. On the other hand, it's seeing the world through networks of nodes, interlinkages. And those two macro dynamics always being in tension with one another. And so, you know, how I can define change right now ultimately hinges on, you know, A, I'm very thankful that my boss is my boss, that within the institute, I do have the flexibility to take advantage of, hey, if we're oriented more towards networks and nodes, it's much easier to get things done. The opportunity costs, right? So this is the policy plan my brain came out again. Having a lot of clarity in what I'm not able to do and being okay with that, knowing full well that the things I'm able to do more than make up for what I would like to do, but I just either don't have the resources, time, or whatever to get done. And that to me, you know, I think that's where the historians who are paying attention to the context in which they find themselves will do really well in life. You know, there's always this phrase about, is the grass greener on the other side? And I'm like, the grass is never greener. You have to water the grass that you're on. And you don't have a say on like what your grass looks like when you get there. You know what I mean?
And
that's just me being a pragmatist on that.
Yeah.
Because I think there's so much to offer and so much to do. And that ultimately shows you like just what's possible. And there's this thing about the role that imagination plays. Like once you see the lay of the land, once you see what's possible, you know, and some people look at constraints and they'll say, man, this is kind of a bummer for X, Y, and Z reasons. And yet when I talk to, you know, designers or when I talk to people who are really creative and I think in a good way, very, very much out there, constraint can be a really great thing because it does show you, one, that in certain cases, of what we're talking about, too much choice is a bad thing.
Okay. Can you give an example when you? Am I pushing too hard for?
No. So, to give you a very real example in my work, right? So when it comes to data science, one of the questions that comes up fairly early on is being able to say, are all of our systems on premise? Are they on some combination of being on premise or in the cloud, or are they only in the cloud? Right.
Okay.
And depending on the answer to that question, that will let you know what kind of tools and approaches are even possible, right?
Oh, right.
So if you want to use really sophisticated cloud-native tools, if you're an on-prem-only organization, you can't really use them. If you're some hybrid organization, it might be possible. And if you're a cloud-native organization, there might be legacy systems that you absolutely cannot use. And again, it's not really like what you can or cannot use. It's getting at the question of what's possible, right? So if somebody comes to me and says, hey, we want to do all of these really cool and fascinating things. We want to be able to predict X, Y, and Z. My first question is always like, hey, it depends. I'm going to have to ask you, I'm going to have to respond to your question with a series of questions. Depending on how that goes, I can tell you what's possible. Based off of that.
Right. Because you have to extrapolate. And extrapolation is a kind of a projection in time also, right?
Yeah, it's a projection in time. It tells you flexibility. It can tell you, you know, I think if somebody's really good at reading the tea leaves about organizations, where are you going to go? How long or how fast is it going to take? And I think, again, for a historian who wants to enter that kind of realm, I think there's two things to get out of it. I think one of them is if you're smart and aware of the context that you're in, you can go really, really far. Your training is an assemblage of tools that can be used in a variety of settings. It doesn't have to be a particular academic or non-academic environment. I know that's the typical kind of line that people use.
Yeah. I think this is very useful as a message to all those people out there, you know, with training in history on various levels that need confidence to kind of go for it and explore these other avenues for sure.
Yeah. And there's people, you know, you want to be an economist of sorts. Cool. You want to go into finance. That's great. I'm a data scientist. Like, there's plenty of examples of historians using their tools for something else. They're still historians in my book. They're using methods. They're using the way of thinking. That doesn't take anything away from them. If anything, they're adding to the fields that they go into.
You know, we've been talking about context. You also signal a word system, which is very much related, right? But I think there's this difference in there in the sense that you have to be able to think abstractly, not just relationally, but kind of abstractly about the structure of how things, about the context that's internal to this whole relationship of the, you know, within the institution, as well as how the system functions in the real world, right? So there are just so many. You zoom in, zoom out. You use both of your the sides of your brain all the time. So that must be a really interesting, cool aspect of your work to be kind of shifting gears like this all the time, no?
That's the fun part of it, frankly. Yeah. Because quietly behind the scenes, it's exciting. You know what needs to be done. You know who to talk to. You can figure out very, very quickly the direction things need to go. You know, there's this part of me that ultimately believes, and I've heard this from friends who decided to go pursue an MBA because they thought they needed to pursue an MBA. And my general thought is like, listen, I'm sure I'll offend a lot of people. I'm very much of like the good old Hunnid school of thought, where you can go to the public library, check out a couple of books, go talk to some really smart people. You can learn a lot of things on the job. You don't need to go get an MBA. Save your money and put it to use elsewhere. But yeah, it absolutely tells you about project management, about how things can be implemented, the way they should be implemented. At least for me, it's taking the different approach again that I think in certain circles can feel countercultural, but to me it feels very pragmatic, which is basically, I'm using a systems level thinking, knowing full well that the system is here before I got here and it's going to be here after I leave.
Yeah.
If I really want to change something, I have to change the system. It can't be about specific individuals. I need to know if I'm building something, it's going to be around after I'm out.
So clearly there are a lot of fun parts to the job. Could you talk a little bit about challenges?
Yeah, I'll be sufficiently vague, but yes. I think some good challenges. One of them is generational. And I don't mean this in a good or a bad way. I mean it's both good and bad, right? So the good part is when it comes to figuring out what context is, talking to people who've been around for a long while and who can give you the skinny on how certain things have developed, right? I think that's invaluable. Where a challenge is, it's just new ways of thinking.
Right.
It's new ways of doing things, knowing full well that, you know, there's sort of two things that I often bump up against. One of them is sometimes folks who have been doing something the same way for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's common word, but you go, you're gonna find folks like that. And I think the second one specific to my work is, you know, again, when it comes to data systems, you know, I mentioned historiography earlier. One of the things I've noticed is through reading reports and trying to understand different kinds of data that was collected is that there were decisions and perceptions of what was important 30 years ago that I'm grappling with now. Because we know certain fields weren't collected. By fields, I mean like race and ethnicity, gender, be where you're from, citizenship status, like those kind of questions. And sometimes that can inhibit, you know, how we begin to understand subpopulations. You know, so again, in my world, I very much exist in a, it's not enough just to have the data and speaking in an aggregate sense, but if we're really going to develop something, I need to know how this will influence subpopulations so that we're going to come up with something. There might be things that we can do that can target our most vulnerable, right? And we can't treat their experiences as being the same as the aggregate population. It's not going to work. It sounds easy to say when I say it like that, but having to speak in averages. Right. It's not the best.
No, it's very interesting, Francisco, what you said right now about the challenges, because I get to see another aspect of how history functions here, because you talked about generational differences, so that, you know, I see it as a kind of a overlapping timelines of people's lives tied to specific periods in the lives of the institutions that you're involved with, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And then you're involved in reading these documents from some time ago, which actually, you know, you discover how Kind of like in the archive, right? I mean, you discover how problems were framed and what kind of solutions were developed that don't necessarily fit into the context of the 21st century, right?
Yeah. I mean, and it highlights this simple intellectual, almost, I don't know, just almost like a foundational belief, right? Mm-hmm. And we know that we know it, and we almost don't question it. We know culture evolves, right? We can say that whenever we're, I don't know, doing a study of France between, I don't know, 1750 to 18, whatever, trying to understand the influence of the French Revolution. We know culture evolves intellectually, and I don't think we understand or fully appreciate how that happens in everyday life. If we're actually a part of changing and creating culture, and you know, I joke around about the archives, but you know, again, I think it's really easy organizationally, certainly in the data world. People come up with something like, and it's bear with me for a minute, something like best practices, right? I hear the word best practices all the time. Well, we're going to come up with something, we'll put forward some best practices, and I'll kind of. And I'm of two minds because it's like I understand that intuitively. And at the same time, like this other half of my brain that's having to try to future-proof things in such a way that things are around after I'm not. Best practices are great, but the technologies and the kind of data I'm dealing with is always evolving. Something's got, like, those things are in tension with one another. So how do we come up with best principles instead? Right? Mm-hmm. So you might hear me say something like, I can't tell you what best practices are going to be in 10 to 15 years because the technology is going to be different. But I think it's absolutely worthwhile to think about how we define transparency, how we define explainability, how we think trust and how it's built into what we do, knowing full well that I can control the methods and what goes in. But some of the calculations are so complicated, it feels like a black box because there's literally hundreds of millions of things going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And when somebody comes to me for something fancy, all I can say is like, listen, the methods are good. The data going in is really solid. That's how I know. This is the answer. I can't necessarily explain how the model gets there or how this really sophisticated approach gets there. Right. You're going to have to trust me on it. You know what I mean?
You're being a futurist in a way, and it's always tricky because we can't predict the twists and turns that the future will take. You know, it reminds me of those covers of US popular magazine, I don't know, from the 40s or 60s, where exactly they said the future, people on the sidewalk, kind of everyone in their own glass pod moving on little vehicle on wheels somewhere. Sort of, I guess, metaphorically, maybe we're there because everyone's looking at their phone, but it turned out differently, right? We're not driving glass pods on sidewalks.
Yeah, frankly, with the drivers in the DC area, I'm glad.
Okay, so outside of DC, we're not driving in the. I know what you mean. So the interesting thing for me is that I feel like you sense intuitively that institutions are. Tend to be by nature conservative, right? Because they put all these procedures in place and they go by them until there's this external force or maybe internal force, which I think is harder, that pushes them in a different direction. And I feel like part of your job is to actually beat that trend and formulate things in such a way that they will give policies, procedures a longer lifespan, which I feel like you are doing it by redefining them a little bit more abstractly.
Because you think about like what goes into an institution, right? And I'm not thinking intellectually here. I mean, like practically, right? We have incentive structures. You're dealing with people, not human resources. There's money. There's future projects. You know, that's starting from the ground up. It is my point. And the general philosophy that underlies a lot of the work really comes from a really smart man named Charlie Munger, which is those, and I'm probably going to butcher this, those who will not face improvements because they are changeless will face changes that are not improved. That's always stuck with me. Because it speaks to something very simple. And that to me, I think is the essence of really good history. I think is the essence of really good business. I think is the essence of being a really good citizen. Taking out all of the white noise, that the attention economy, the politics, the nonsense that we're floating around, and being able to say at the end of the day, what are the core things that are the most important to us? Why? So it gets to this question of like, yeah, you tell me you want to go forward and into the future. I need to know what your foundations are. Like, and keeping it as simple as possible,
right,
being honest about that. Not even the more honest and simple that is, it doesn't really, you know, you don't have to be there and know full well that the structure you've built is going to be around.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're talking about. The boiling to its very essence part, the eliminating the noise and trying to preserve something that's core that can last a little longer. I like that a lot. Well, thanks for sharing the challenges as well as the delights of your work.
Of course.
Every job has those, right? So I wanted to ask you a question about your personal project, which I know you have. If it's okay.
Yeah, no, public.
I know you've been putting the historical thinking, your passion for historical thinking and your passion for data science to work in this fascinating project related to your own family history. In which you go as far back as the 10th century. And I'm really intrigued about how you're able to go back so far, where you trace your family back to the 16th century. Later, still far back. And I was very moved by your description of this project. Quoting here from your post on LinkedIn, quote, "I'm sharing this because so much of life happens between numbers, points in time we mark and give value to. Whether we call them p-values, clusters, ICCs, or something else, professions, fields, and societies are only as good as the people who are encouraged and allowed to enter," unquote. So here's my question. And by the way, I don't know what ICCs are, but I'll ask a question anyway.
All right. Yeah.
So clearly historical thinking shaping your thinking about who you are and about the world, but maybe you could elaborate on what this project has meant to you. That's what I was curious about.
Oh, this project means everything. Speaking as a person, not as a data scientist, just speaking as a person. So I'm Latino, right? I consider El Paso, Texas, my hometown. I grew up in a town called Lubbock, Texas. I was born in an even smaller town called Big Spring, Texas. And the thing I've come to learn growing up is there is sort of an implicit pressure to devalue your own history, right? Whether it's other people telling you that you're not as important, that you're not as valuable, that you should speak that English only and not Spanish. You know, a lot of these really, really raw emotions and forces that are imposed on kids. So you're led to believe that you're less than. And I had this moment, and I keep having these moments throughout the years, whether I'm talking to family members, cousins, people I literally randomly met on the subway before, about their lives, my life, and how do they know it's getting better, right? Like, just generally. And for me, there were a series of conversations I had at where, for that particular project, I spent about 5.5 years just knee-deep in records, right? Got on a plane a couple of times, flew to different places, got on the phone with people who know way more about a lot of things than I do, to collecting family photos, right? And one of the things about me that will always be there is this question of dignity. You know, it really is the ultimate of me trying to understand where I'm from, to understand more broadly where my people are from, that we do have a history, we do have a culture, that we are tied and connected in ways that we understand, and frankly, more ways that we don't, you know? And I think that's also fascinating. I've met people with the same surname from my mom's side and it turns out through a conversation, we're from the same, like historically from the same small town, and we can piece together where it's super distantly related. It happens. And I think the other part of it too is to serve as, I don't know if it's a voice in the wind or a candle in the dark, whatever visual metaphor you want to use, that we're here, you know? And the thing about that is, even talking to my mom, being able to tell her, like, in many ways, our story is the story. Like I'm looking at people, frankly, Herbert's great-uncle, great-great-uncle, this dude was a day laborer. And at one point during World War II, he simultaneously registered with the U.S. government for World War II. He was in his early 40s. And he picked beats in Idaho. And then he moves to LA. He ends up pouring concrete, lives in that house for about, I think the monthly rent was $10 a month. And explains why I have a lot of people in California that I'm blissfully related to. There's another one. One of them, you know, and I'm just speaking ad lib, so I'm sorry. This is very much true.
No, please do it. It's even, fascinating. Yeah.
Even something like these massive events, right, that aren't in history books, right? So you talk about like the importance of historical thinking, and then
right.
at least for me realizing how bad in certain ways the education I received was when I learned what actually happened and what wasn't written down. In the 1930s, the repatriation of around 600,000 to 2 million Mexicans and Mexican-Americans from the United States. Basically, these were people, vast majority of which were birthright citizens, who were deported back to Mexico. Mm-hmm. That's my grandmother, you know? And it primarily happened, I think most of the people were rounded up in L.A. You had people in Chicago, Iowa, all over the country. I never read about it in a history book. And it wasn't until I started interviewing family members who knew some of the old timers really, really well. Granted, my grandmother died in 1990, so I was six. And, you know, when you're six, you don't know any better. But you start understanding these contradictions where she grew up in LA speaking English. She didn't really understand Spanish. She was raised gastronomically. She was raised on like cottage cheese.
Mm-hmm.
These really, you know, pot roasts, you know what I mean? Like these really American dishes. She's expatriated in, I think, 1932, 1933. She moves to this town called Ciudad Juarez, which right now is a massive, massive city. But at the time, it wasn't as big. The border wasn't as guarded, would be militarized, would be one way to put it, by a plot of land that was given by the Mexican government. And she ends up going to this small school. She's teased because she doesn't know English. I mean, she doesn't know Spanish. She only knows English.
Right.
She eats foods that aren't locally available because no one at that time in Ciudad Juarez would eat cottage cheese or it just casseroles hadn't made it down yet. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so it's these kinds of contradictions, right? We talk about history in these very abstract terms about what are the underlying push and pull factors, right? How did this, you know, these really jargonistic terms that at the end of the day, we lose sight of how personal they are to people, right? Like we have these amazing, in quotation marks, events happening all the time where people are clearly motivated by something within them.
Right.
Right. The sociologists, Bourdieu would call it their habitus, right? These internalized schemes of perception that are informed by the history and culture. Mm-hmm. And if that is the catalyst for action, I mean, for me, that's everything. You know, I don't think of myself as having, if I'm remembered for anything, it's not going to be for my professional work. Like, I think people remember I did really great work. I advanced things in certain areas. I have no illusions that I'm going to ever be remembered like an Obama. Like, it's just not going to happen. And I'm okay with that. But I think it's going to be more of this humanitarian perspective that, you know, we belong. Our history is American history.
Yeah.
Our family can be traced. Our roots go deeper than damn near anybody else's. And, you know, the only thing that we don't have is we don't have, you know, the money. We don't have the historical PR machine that you see coming out of the East.
Right.
It just doesn't exist, right? You have a Mayflower Society. And I know this because I live on these.
You're talking about institutions, basically, right?
Yeah, we don't have it. Like people go on and on and on about, you know, Harvard being founded in 16 whatever. And I'm like, yeah, my people were here in 15 whatever. Like, like what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know? The fact that I know the name of the actual guy, the actual fourth wave of the conquistador who came from Spain, you know, so that's the part of me where, at least for me, we talk about how people unlearn, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is arguably harder and more important than not just for professional success, which don't get me wrong, it's critical. I think for a lot of people, it's almost as existentially important to know where you're from.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't have that. You know, I mentioned my colleague at Duke earlier. I'm not going to say his name, but he's a black man who has been at the university for some time. And I was talking about this history project with him, and he would tell me pretty candidly, the only way I, as a Black man, can know my ancestors is I have to actually go to graveyards and look for names.
Right.
Because nothing was written down.
Right.
And I can't imagine trying to function or live having that kind of absence within me. And mm-hmm. so I can understand where and how my history diverges and converges with people. Me,
mm-hmm.
that to me is incredibly yeah. powerful and incredibly meaningful. And it, you know, I know it's something that's going to occupy the rest of my life. I think the next yeah. step beyond, literally, I think it was around 1,100 people that I ended up looking into. You know, 29 generations talking to historians from all over the place to reaching out for right. libraries is taking the next step and being able to ask. I've never seen a documentary on some of these histories.
Right.
There is yeah. nothing preventing me from actually talking to people who are well-versed in that world and asking them, I have an idea for a project and here's some money that I can cobble together. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I love how you're working on it from, you know, from several ends by trying to put the faces on maybe some of these individuals that may be unknown or who may just be anonymous, but at the same time you're trying to bring it all together in this genealogical tree, and by doing this you're giving a presence, a history, a legitimacy, respectability, everything there to show, like you said, that you know you were there for so long, right? I guess, you know, I mean, I have so many questions, and I'm afraid I cannot ask all of them here because what's interesting to me is that, you know, this historical thinking essentially ties, it seems, your personal life, personal projects, and your projects at work, and it's in so many ways. I don't think it's like this for everyone, but I think the fact that you're doing this and that you are talking about this, I think highlights the importance of historical thinking in all these dimensions. So fascinating. And I do hope to ask those other questions at some point, you know, like,
sure.
for instance, I'm curious to know who's the strangest figure that you were able to...
I can answer that one. Her name is Delfina. And what's fascinating about Delfina, so she lived and was born, and I say, I think, in 1888, right? So I think she was born in 1888. I think she passed away around 1954. And it was this wild character because people who knew her would go on and on and on about all of these truths that she told family that ended up not being true. Right. So on one hand, I have all these interviews that go around, and then you try to independently confirm all this other stuff and you can't.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So then I started looking at things like border crossing cards, census records, death certificates, combing through marriage documents. None of the dates matched. I mean, none. So when I say I think there's something from like 1887, 1891, we uh-huh. think it happened then. And the most reliable thing ended up being the border crossing cards, because the way it worked then, and I'm sure the way it works now, is, you know, somebody's standing at a booth, you hand them your documents, they stamp it, and that's mm-hmm. the only way I knew on these specific dates that she went from Ciudad Juarez over to El Paso or vice versa. I don't even know the year that she died.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a year and a half trying to understand and basically reading tea leaves. You know,
mm-hmm.
you've got a hole in the archives, you're trying to deduce based on a ton of background reading. What might somebody do given these circumstances? And just can't do it, man. I threw up my arms after 2 years trying to understand this person because you can't.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm gonna have to go back cruelly to a couple of concluding questions.
Go for it.
About maybe some things that you might be able to say about, you know, in terms of the bigger picture of connecting history to careers and the professional world.
Yeah.
One of those questions is, you know, what should executives and hiring managers know about historians to appreciate the value of historical training in a few words, would you say?
In a few words, if you want to know where you can go, you've got a book at what you're from. Historians do a better job than anyone else in trying to figure out these foundational questions. And then I think we get a lot of short shrift in conversations. What are our values? what's our mission? Why are we here? And what are we doing? And does whatever future steps that we're thinking about doing, right? And I'm being industry agnostic for a reason. I think historians can fit in. You can talk tech, you can talk business. I'm in the nonprofit / philanthropy world, certainly in government. We'll do a better job of actually being futurists than most people, because they can tell you what's failed in the past, why it failed, what hasn't been tried, what's worth trying, to even thinking about, you know, my world, what are the odds? What are the odds something succeeds, something fails? What are the stories?
That's very helpful, because I think we're also incentivized very often to think always about the future and to focus on the future. And the past seems dead, but actually it's not, right?
Because, no. The past, whether we like it or not, it's a long shadow. And it's a lot longer than we are.
A long shadow. I like that. It's very poetic. My other and last question would be, what do you think, in terms of practical measures, history departments could do to connect students to careers in the private sector?
Several things. My general MO has always been, find connections in places where you usually don't go. Just go hang out with other people. Business schools, right? Go talk to medical school. And establish relationships there. Try to come up with different ways of, going to places where you just don't go. You know, at Duke, it was always around digital humanities, you know, which is really like, how do we apply technology and art into this project to create something new? That kind of stuff, right? Because it's really not about, and I'm sure both of you agree, to me, it's not about the specific project on a certain topic. It's really like, what are the tools and the kind of thinking that somebody's taking away from their experience of hanging out and reading and exploring and hopefully doing their own history. That to me is the real stuff. And if somebody has that internalized and knows, you can drop them in any environment and that doesn't go away. It just gets applied.
Right.
That's all that is to me.
Right. I like that a lot. I think also because maybe especially when you're still at the university, you envision yourself as, or you want to be a part of a community somewhere in the next couple of years. And you think that the best way of doing it, and sometimes it may be, is by seeking people who are like you, right? But it's actually very useful in the long run to also meet people who are unlike you in what they do, right? Yeah. And that kind of makes you grow in a lot of ways. So
you don't know who, at the end of the day, is going to be a friend. You don't know who's going to be a future connection. You have no idea what job markets are going to look like.
Right.
And it's, to me, that's just a basic fact that I think sometimes gets lost. I can count and think of a lot of people who wanted to be professors and they graduated at horrible times. Like, what do you do in 2008 when the economy's falling apart?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know what to tell you. Like, I'm sorry. It was the only thing I can really say. Like, what
you
do
have to find
with,
another way.
You've got to find another way. And I think that's maybe can't be taught, but helping people find another way.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Francisco. Thank you very much for sharing all your insights into your career, into the context of your career trajectory and your personal projects. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.